White Area and Resistance calling. White Area and Resistance calling. This is White Area and Resistance, and this is Terrible Tommy in the bunker here in North Central Indiana. We're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581, baby. And this is Terrible Tommy, and now on with the show.
His book is Another 19. His website is another19.com. Use the numbers, ANOTHER19.com. Kevin Ryan, welcome to the program. First time guest. Glad to have you.
Thank you, John. I'm glad to be with you tonight.
This is a brand new book. Copyright's 2013. So how long has it been out?
It's only been out about 2 months.
Love it. Well, I received your copy and just started reading it, and I just thought, oh, I mean, I had to stop every once in a while and just not put my face in both hands, but just put a palm against my forehead and just lean on that elbow for a minute and go, good grief, how deep does this really go? Tell us about you and your what led you to be with Underwriters Laboratories and what happened then, and just take it away.
Well, I'm a chemistry laboratory manager by trade, and that's how I ended up working for Underwriters Laboratories. And I led a division of UL for a number of years. And when I worked there, I was in communication with the chief executive officer and also other top managers at UL, and learned that the company had, back in the 1960s, had done the fire resistance testing for the steel components used in the World Trade Center towers. And that's basically the kind of work that UL does, including the division that I worked for. We did safety testing of all sorts of things.
And is that destructive testing in many cases?
That's right, it is. And in case of the steel components, the idea is to prepare them in exactly the form that they'd be used in a building, and to use a standard test to test the fire resistance, the ability to hold its load, and the transference of temperature. And this is all done in huge furnaces in various locations that UL owns. So what they did for the World Trade Center was they ensured that the steel columns and the floor assemblies used in the towers would be able to withstand very intense fires for hours. In fact, the steel used in the World Trade Center towers was certified to withstand 3 hours in terms of the floor assemblies and 4 hours of intense fire in terms of the columns. And one of the glaring problems with that is one of the World Trade Center towers was completely destroyed in only 56 minutes.
At what temperature, Kevin?
Well, in the temperatures in a typical office fire are about 1,200 degrees Fahrenheit. And in the furnaces, they're 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit. And as I said, they're exposed to these temperatures for hours and not just a few minutes.
Right.
So the World Trade Center was designed to withstand the impact of airliners. That was stated very clearly by the man who was the chief design engineer, John Skilling. And in addition, the steel components were certified to ensure that they would withstand hours of intense fire. That's not what happened on 9/11. No, and so in 2003, I began asking questions about this, primarily because, frankly, I was politically ignorant in many ways, looking back in hindsight now. But, you know, it occurred to me after, it was clear to me that the lies that were used to start the Iraq War were told in a concerted effort. There was actually an organized effort, including people like Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld, to lie the American public into this enormous war. And that led me to ask when the lying might have begun. And it reminded me of these communications I had with UL executives. And so I started asking questions. And for about a year, I asked questions at UL about how this could have happened. And I found that no one at the company could explain. It could have been destroyed in the way that the official reports said that they were. I was told to wait for this report from the National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST, and I did that. And when I saw the report, I found that the report ignored the physical tests that were done as part of the investigation, which my company helped to perform. They built floor models of the World Trade Center floors, put them in the furnaces again, they did steel at the World Trade Center. They ended up writing to the government, and that is otherwise not available to the public with regard to a company's activities or the government's activities. Open to that? I welcome that. As I believe, you know, I'm an American citizen, and I believe that we as American citizens have an obligation to take control of our destiny, not allow this the origin of the war on terror to devastate the truth that leads to justice. And that's my mission, has been for 10 years now.
Kevin, you know, this is really quite a pregnant point that you have made, and that is that even asking an indiscreet question could constitute whistleblowing and the vilification that follows it.
Yeah, and, you know, so my questions were very pointed, very specific about the tests that were performed by NIST and UL and how the report conclusions ignored those tests. And as a laboratory manager doing similar types of testing, meaning testing to national standards, that would never have been even considered in the laboratories that I managed, where you would run a test and you would totally ignore the results in order to come up with what ultimately was a political conclusion supporting the preconceived notions of what happened on 9/11.
Now, the NIST is, as you pointed out, is the National Institute of Standards and Technology, and it was formerly known as the National Bureau of Standards.
Yeah.
How can you get away ignoring the testing of the structure, and it doesn't come into public awareness at all? They just go right on by it.
Well, over the years, we've found that people from NIST have expressed the fact that they were under a lot of pressure to essentially support the political story, and I believe that's common. Now that I've learned more in government scientist work, basically, you know, they're paid to overlook things that don't support the political framework that they are paid by. And so it's not terribly surprising to me now, but at the time I was really just outraged. I couldn't believe that, especially given the import, you know, what 9/11 really meant to all of us, I couldn't believe that scientists would just falsify their work. And now, to some extent, I have to say that I'm sure they're honest people at NIST, although perhaps not as not brave enough to speak out and lose their job. But the conclusions, I believe, were framed by different people than the people who did the actual testing. So it may be a complicated situation in that regard.
Well, you know, we have a couple hours and a half. We do have a number of commercials that we play, and we got about 40 minutes per hour for actual conversation. So if I seem to be pushing us along here, you just kind of control it from your end. We'll both fly this airplane tonight, okay?
Okay.
Some of the points that you make here, the many opportunities for U.S. intelligence agencies to track down and capture the alleged hijackers should have resulted in the attacks being stopped before they happened. Another point you make, four planes should not have been hijacked because the systems in place to prevent hijackings should have been effective. Then the U.S. chain of command should have responded to the attacks immediately, but it did not. And then the U.S. National Air Defenses should have responded effectively, and some, if not all, of the hijacked aircraft should have been intercepted by military jets, but were not. And the three WTC buildings should not have fallen through what should have been the path of most resistance. And then, of course, there's Building 7 and that famous BBC report where the the correspondent is talking about the building having collapsed and standing in the background. Then they go off the air, and then they come back. Oh, we've reconnected with our correspondent. Go ahead. And the building's down at that point. My problem with all of this, Kevin, is where is the outrage? I mean, you're talking about you're an American citizen. I'm an American citizen. I want the answers. You feel like we should have the answers so that we can, you know, forge our way through the future with you know, a foundation of truth and some integrity, and yet it's just not happening.
Yeah, well, there actually are millions of Americans who have been crying out for the truth about 9/11 and for many years. In 2006, there was a poll by Scripps Howard that showed that 36% of the American public believe that in some way the Bush administration must have been either involved or allowed the 9/11 attacks to occur so that, the country could go to war in the Middle East. And so there have definitely been many people calling for the truth about 9/11. There is, unfortunately, I found a need to improve on the media sources that we look to. For example, Coast to Coast provides information that you're not going to find on CNN and others. And we need to support those kinds of media if we're ever really going to allow these kinds of questions to progress until we find truth and justice and hopefully, ultimately, some peace in our lives.
Well, all right then. But as we see, how long have we been in the Middle East now? This is the 10th year. We went in there in March of 03, right? Yeah.
Yeah, October 2001 actually is when we invaded Afghanistan. But you're right, March 2003 is when we invaded Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now you're talking here about another 19. Now, is that literally 19 other people, or is that title a metaphorical title?
Yeah, it's somewhat of a metaphorical title. The idea is to state, okay, the government has finally told us what they believe occurred, and they say that there were 19 young Arab Muslim men. Led by Osama bin Laden, and if you look closer, another fellow by the name of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. So these 21 people really pulled off this completely unbelievable attack, overcoming the trillion-dollar defense system, intelligence system of the United States. The point of the book is to say, okay, we know what you said. Those of us who have read the 9/11 Commission report and the NIST report have found them very lacking in terms of providing the actual answers. So, you know, some of these things could really not have been accomplished by young Arab Muslim men. We could talk for a long time about that. But we can, as independent citizens, suggest ways in which these questions that haven't been answered, which you nicely outlined, how did three tall buildings fall through what should have been the path of most resistance? How could the national air defenses have been disabled for 2 hours and so forth and so on? We can propose 19 other people in this book, I do, who were actually in position to make those things happen exactly as they did. And, you know, for my part, I spent 6 years investigating the scientific side of this, the World Trade Center specifically. And in the last 4 years, I decided to say, I said to myself, well, we've been calling for an investigation for so long. Why don't we start doing some of this investigation? And that was the point with another 19. Let's look at another 19 people, partly because people seem to believe that it's, you know, the official account is more believable because it's only 19 people. Well, here's only 19 people who actually had the power to do what was done and still not been explained.
Understood. All right, then. Yeah, this is an interesting little quote right at the top of Chapter 2 of Kevin Ryan's book, Another 19. Quote, he's a ruthless little bastard. You can be sure of that. And that's former President Richard Nixon describing Donald Rumsfeld. What a perfect cover. We'll talk about that with Kevin Ryan when we come back. What a perfect cover. You're going to war for the oil, but we didn't take the oil. Well, you're going to war so Halliburton can rebuild the whole country. That didn't happen either. So if that didn't happen, doesn't that lend some credibility to the so-called official story that this really was a fight against terror? We'll be right back. Never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th. You know, I've said this before, and I'll say it again to make sure that everybody who may possibly tune in to the Saturday night edition of Coast to Coast AM or any other broadcast where your humble narrator and talk show guy, John D. Wells, that's me, might be presiding over. I liked George Bush in the beginning. I thought he was an okay guy. At first blush, when these attacks on the World Trade Center occurred, I thought, yeah, it's kind of good to have a Wyatt Earp character in there going, yeah, we're going to go kick some rump over this. And it started looking worse and worse and worse. So, as much as I may have liked you at one time, Mr. Bush, I got to tell you, we're going to continue to entertain these, what might be called outrageous conspiracy theories, until somebody comes up with an answer that doesn't make Mickey Mouse look like a genius. Okay. Are we clear? Okay, good. Another 19, that's the book. Another 19, that's the website. Use the number 19, another19.com. The work by Kevin Robert Ryan. We'll be right back. This is Coast to Coast AM. Kevin Ryan, tell me, if you will, and a few million of our closest friends, just a couple of guys talking here in the big room, what was the stated reason for Underwriters Laboratories to cut you loose?
Well, they said that I had harmed their relationship with the client, NIST. So NIST was a client of UL. And in my termination letter, which I still have, of course, is just the statement that that I had harmed the company's relationship with its client, NIST.
Yeah. I'm curious about something. Sometimes I'll ask a question, and if you don't want to go into it, just say, no, I don't want to go there, and I'll let it go, or seriously. But what sort of a reception did you get when you because a couple of these radio outlets were certainly left-leaning, and they're not going to support the Republican president no matter what. They'll take a shot at him. That's just how it is. You know, we get that. Right does to the left does to the right. And like I say, one prostitute works one side of the street, one works the other side of the street, and the street goes that way, and we're all going that way. Yeah. What sort of response did you get when you went on NPR and Air America and outlets like that?
Well, different responses. So on NPR, I was brought into a show called On Point, and they brought in a substitute host. And they also brought in two people who are known in the subject as debunkers. So they brought in James Miggs of Popular Mechanics, Hearst publication. They brought in a Canadian man named Jonathan Kay, and the subject was about 9/11 skepticism. So they invited me as the sole 9/11 skeptic. And basically every 30 seconds they use some form of the term conspiracy theorist. They gave me about 5 minutes to respond to that in the hour-long show. So that wasn't very good. But on Air America, I debated a man named Michael Shermer, who is the editor of a magazine called Skeptic. And it turns out Shermer is not very skeptical about most things that are risk to authoritarian power. But that went fairly well, and we were both given fair and equal amounts of time, and so that went pretty well. I've also been on Pacifica Radio, where generally it's the same sort of thing, a debate format. They try to let everybody have their say.
Okay. I was just curious. I wondered if because the political orientation, it might have gone more pro-conspiracy theory than against it.
Well, I tend to agree with you now that I've learned more about the history of things like false flag terrorism and the kind of relationship between media and government that I've seen over the last 10 years. I agree that the two-party system is something of a mirage, that there really, as Gore Vidal once said, there's really only one party in the United States. It's the property party, and it has two right wings. And I'm not sure exactly what he meant by right, but there does appear to be just one party in the United States.
The rentier class, they're pretty much useless other than taking money from other people for something that's a tangible asset, whether it's rent or whether it's your job. Rumsfeld, Donald Rumsfeld's name just keeps coming up and coming up. A lot of people didn't like him. They thought he was a harsh man, and then I couldn't resist reading that quote from the beginning of Chapter 2. He's a ruthless little bastard, that one, says Richard Nixon. So how can you put Rumsfeld's position into perspective for us? Did he have a little bit? I sense that he had much more influence than even we thought, and he appeared to have quite a bit.
Right. Yes, he did, and his colleague Dick Cheney also did, and the two of them represent an alternative Osama bin Laden and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed for this book. So they aren't among the 19. They're the two people who were in perfect position to coordinate the attacks of 9/11. And Donald Rumsfeld has a very interesting history going back to the 60s when he worked for a private intelligence firm, and that launched him into a career in politics. He was a congressman for a number of years and became close with Gerald Ford, who ultimately helped him further along in his career. But Rumsfeld, for whatever reason, as a very young man in his early 30s, was given promotions into the Nixon administration and then the Ford administration that were really unprecedented in terms of the power that he held. He was a special assistant to Nixon. Then he became the White House Chief of Staff for Ford and the Secretary of Defense, the youngest Secretary of Defense, and then many years later, the oldest Secretary of Defense. But during the 90s, he really started showing that his approach seemed to be very hawkish. He was founder of the Project for a New American Century, PNAC. People may have heard of that. Neoconservative group that published really extremist sort of interventionist policy recommendations.
Yep.
And he, believe it or not, early in 2001, he made several comments stating essentially that nothing would change that needed to change until there was another Pearl Harbor. And that's the name of another book on 9/11 just began going into the questions that haven't been answered. But Rumsfeld on 9/11 was missing during the height of the attacks, and he was actually the second most powerful person. As President Bush and the Secretary of Defense were what's called the National Command Authority. And one of the reasons that it appears that the 9/11 attacks were accomplished is that neither President Bush was available. He was pretty much taken out of the picture, and also Secretary Rumsfeld took himself out of the picture and just went missing at the height of the attacks for more than 30 minutes. So Rumsfeld and his partner Dick Cheney should be focused on, and I go into that in the book to some extent, and also how all of these other 19 suspects connect with these two men over the years, and how they have the same sort of motivations.
You know, here in your book, I just wanted to back up from the actual text what you just said. It's like by the time the second plane hit the WTC, Rumsfeld had moved on to a meeting with the CIA briefer. Reports vary on where he was after that, but National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice claimed she could not reach him. Some said that Rumsfeld continued with regularly scheduled meetings after the second strike, and he was on a roll with his predictions that morning. Apparently, he told Congressman Christopher Cox, "Believe me, this isn't over yet. There's going to be another attack, and it could be us." Minutes later, the Pentagon was hit. That's almost a, I don't know, case could be made for it being, just can't resist letting a little bit of "I know" something slip out. Maybe it's hubris or...
Right.
You know what I mean?
This love of power seems to be a characteristic of Rumsfeld and Cheney over the years, and so that seems to be reflected in those statements as well.
Give us a little profile on Dick Cheney.
Well, Dick Cheney was behind the lies that started the 1990 Gulf War, the first Gulf War. People may not know that there were two major lies that started that first Gulf War, and Dick Cheney was behind both of them, one of them being that there was a buildup of Iraqi troops on the Saudi border. That's how he convinced the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia to allow American troops on Saudi Arabian soil and help them, therefore, invade Kuwait after Saddam Hussein had invaded Kuwait. We went in there with our troops and drove them out. But the other lie was told by a young Kuwaiti girl. She was coached by a company called Hill & Knowlton to tell lies about Iraqi soldiers taking babies out of incubators and leaving them on the cold floor to die. Well, Cheney was behind that as well with Hill & Knowlton. And another suspect was actually, in this book, was closely related to Naira, is her name, as well, as I get into later into the book. But Dick Cheney, he's behind these Gulf War lies. He and Don were behind the 2003 lies to start the Iraq War. And in between there, we're essentially being told by the 9/11 Commission and others that we're to trust these people about their activities and what they say about 9/11. President Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney both actively sought to prevent any investigation into 9/11. You know, they called Tom Daschle, the Senate leader, and they actively sought to defund it. It was only funded at one-tenth of the amount that was allotted to investigate President Clinton's sexual exploits. So it was clear that that these men did not want an investigation into 9/11, and on 9/11, Dick Cheney was definitely in a position of power, and the most important person at the White House. He was in control in the bunker of the White House, the office called the Presidential Emergency Operations Center, and as well as that, there's been testimony from Secretary of Transportation Norman Mineta that Dick Cheney was tracking one of the planes as it came into Washington. This is a somewhat famous testimony. Mineta said that a young man would come into the PEOC and tell Vice President Cheney that the plane was 50 miles out, and then he'd come back in and say the plane is 30 miles out. And when it came down to 10 miles out, he asked the Vice President, "Do the orders still stand?" And the Vice President whipped his neck around and said, "Of course the orders still stand. Have you heard anything to the contrary?"
Yep, I've heard that one.
These are the exact words of the testimony to the 9/11 Commission of Secretary of Transportation Norman Mineta, who, by the way, has stood by that testimony for years and still does, that Dick Cheney was aware of one of the planes coming in, although the official account said nobody knew anything about it. And there's some sort of orders that were given. So Cheney is very suspicious with regard to 9/11, and he's the one most suspected of having been involved.
What do you make of, Kevin, as we go through this thing, our interview is just like I say, a couple of guys talking here, so I'm almost like, wow, a new friend. I want to ask him all kinds of stuff. Before we leave the destructive testing, do you happen to know what temperature Jet A burns at?
Well, jet fuel burns at actually a lower temperature than office furnishings.
And like 900 to 1100 degrees, isn't it?
That's right. And what's more important with jet fuel is that everyone, including NIST, all of the government investigators, agree that the jet fuel burned off in just a few minutes. So as far as the failure of the steel, allegedly, or the destruction of the buildings, all the jet fuel did was make a big explosion. and kind of theatrically, you know, give us this notion that there was something terrible happening. Of course, there was. There was many poor people. There were many poor people dying in the buildings. But the jet fuel burned off in only about 5 minutes, according to NIST. So it was the fires that were fed by office furnishings that, according to NIST, caused this vast amount of steel in the building to originally to melt, and then they changed that to soften. And then finally, after I spoke out, they changed took all the softened wording out, and 7 months later came up with another report that said the steel had simply weakened. And, you know, this is unbelievable. I mean, it's like being given many different stories and having the media ask us to believe each one as they come through.
I thought that was just, you know, I talked to a friend of mine some years ago that probably within 18 months after the event, he said, no, I've been on the internet. And I said, that, you know, that sure looks like controlled demolition to me. I'm sorry, but, you know, wouldn't you think if something crashed in on one side, something would tip over or something? But instead, it just goes straight down. Both of them just go straight down like that. So I'm going out in the clothesline. I say it was controlled demolition. A lot of people think so. What do you think?
Absolutely. In fact, that's one of the premises of the latter half of the book, is that explosives were used at the World Trade Center. And, you know, there's not just the false official accounts to support that, which people should see the struggle that NIST went through of many different accounts, from pancake theory to columns-only theory to other theories, and finally this kind of vague pile-driver theory that they have now. These were all failed attempts to explain how the buildings were destroyed through non-explosive means. But they never looked at the explosive demolition theory, and there's a great deal of support for that from near freefall acceleration of the buildings. For one thing, you know, we're talking about removing hundreds of connections, you know, bolts and welds per second, hundreds per second would have to be uniformly, simultaneously removed in order for the buildings to do what they did. And, you know, we also see in the photographs these things that are called squibs. They're these high-velocity bursts of material shooting out like a cannon from the side of the building, not just from the collapse zone, but up to 30 floors below the collapse zone, these cannon shots. So those cannot be explained through a fire-based explanation. And not only that, but there were many witnesses to explosions and flashes of light and so on and so on. All of the evidence really points to the buildings having been destroyed through the use of explosives. Now, that in itself doesn't necessarily discount the 19 original suspects, except that I have done a great deal of investigation into who might have had access to those buildings in order to place explosives in them, and I don't see any evidence for these young, you know, the average age of the people who were accused was only about 20 years old, and they're from foreign countries, mostly Saudi Arabia. And they just didn't have access to these buildings to plant explosives.
That doesn't sound good. Well, I'll tell you what, I can't believe the first hour is over already, but we have two more to go. So when we come back, let's go back to the personnel who were in charge of various agencies at the time this travesty was perpetrated. But good night. This is More Unbelievable, Charlie Romeo Alpha Papa. Rummy was in the Pentagon when it was attacked. He was missing because he was helping with the wounded. Have you heard anything to that effect? I haven't.
Yes, I have. But if you imagine that, this is right after the building, the Pentagon, was struck. And at the time, there were said to be multiple planes still in the air, hijacked and flying around the country.
Right.
And Rumsfeld, instead of contacting his subordinate in charge of the air defenses, Ralph Eberhardt, He claims that he just went out to the parking lot in the lawn to see if he could help. Now, obviously, there were a lot of people already helping there. That's not really what we needed the Secretary of Defense to do.
No, we got people for that.
Right. But more importantly, people like President Bush and Condoleezza Rice have made it clear they could not contact the Secretary of Defense for more than 30 minutes. So not only was he doing something that we didn't want him to do, but he wasn't available to speak to the president or the national security advisor at the height of the 9/11 attacks.
Yeah, it's a good thing they didn't send a second whatever it was toward the Pentagon, or he might have been a casualty himself.
Right. It seems like, you know, he must have known with all the things he was saying about Pearl Harbor before it happened, and then he actually stated that the Pentagon would be a good next target after the second World Trade Center tower was hit. He stated that. And so then, you know, the fact that he went and kind of lost himself, and when he was most needed, that was the point in his career, he was most needed by the United States, lost himself. That leads us to wonder if he knew what was going on, and perhaps he was looking to see if it was carried out well, or just removing himself from the situation.
All right, very good. Now, we do need to take this little floating break quickly, but I wanted to get back so not lose the momentum, you know. So let's take 2 minutes here real quick and then come right back to discuss another 19, Investigating Legitimate 9/11 Suspects by Kevin Robert Ryan on Coast to Coast AM. Am I? All right, Mr. Ryan, let's carry on here. What about FBI Director Free, Louis Free?
Well, Louis Free, along with George Tenet, who was director of the CIA, are in the book because they led agencies which appeared to simultaneously hype the threat of terrorism while not actually doing anything to prevent terrorism. And the FBI situation is pretty extreme. And I gave 15 examples in the book in which Louis Free's FBI, which was an agency that he led from 1993 to June of 2001, was either facilitating or covering up acts of terrorism. And this includes domestic terrorism, and I go through the many connections between the events at Oklahoma City in 1995 and the 9/11 attacks. It includes TWA Flight 800, which has become a hot topic of discussion lately due to a new film of that name that's come out. The investigators of that event are actually now calling for a new investigation into that tragedy. But also, you know, there are some clear pieces of evidence that Louis Free's FBI was working with people who are seen as terrorists. So, for example, the man who was said to have trained leaders of Al-Qaeda is a guy named Ali Mohammed, and he was an FBI informant throughout the time that Free was the director. He was a special forces sergeant in the United States Army. He was, you know, somebody who trained people like bin Laden, al-Zawahiri. So, you know, the problem with this is that he was arrested in 1998, and he was allowed to plea bargain, and he's still never been brought to trial. It's like he's being protected. And Louis Free was the one who kind of started that. There are other examples, like I said, 15 examples of where the FBI seemed to be protecting these people who were said, were told are terrorists. Two of the alleged 9/11 hijackers, for example, were living with an FBI informant for months in 2000, the year 2000. They were brought to San Diego, and they were hooked up, it appears, with Saudi agents who were also FBI informants or FBI assets. And I go into that in the book and talk about how Louis Free not only kind of appeared to lead this agency that facilitated or covered up terrorism, but they then, after 9/11, refused to cooperate with the 9/11 investigation. And Louis Free appears to have been someone who was close to the Saudi Prince Bandar, who is now the intelligence chief of Saudi Arabia, but back at that time was the ambassador to the United States from Saudi Arabia. So he was very close to Prince Bandar, had secret communications channels, much like director of CIA George Tenet did. And then finally I go into the fact that after 9/11, both George Tenet and Louis Free joined the board of a company that had been flagged for 9/11 insider trading by the Securities and Exchange Commission. Now to me, that if the government is not interested in looking through the 15 events in which the FBI seems to have facilitated terrorism, they might be interested in both Free and Tenet, the leaders of the U.S. intelligence community, joining a company that had been flagged for 9/11 insider trading. That should really be compelling. In any case, Louis Free and George Tenet are just two of the 19 suspects, and what I try to do in the first half of the book is kind of set up the issue. So, there certainly is truth to the fact that there's an Al-Qaeda organization, and now what we don't know is who is Al-Qaeda, who supports Al-Qaeda. But if we go back to the 1980s, we learn that the United States funded the precursor to and trained the Mujahideen, the precursor organization to Al-Qaeda. Osama bin Laden, there's evidence that Osama bin Laden was funded by the CIA. And so we wonder, in 2001, if Al-Qaeda was not still an asset organization for Western intelligence agencies, including the United States. And so that's what I try to get to in the first half of the book, kind of setting up the myth of Al-Qaeda and terrorism and that being the greatest threat to the United States, and the fact that simultaneously these men were not investigating, they were not trying to prevent terrorism.
This is very, very, this is disturbing, because it makes you wonder if the guys and gals that are CIA officers, and if CIA is primarily the double meaning here, of the execution arm of policy, who then is really setting the policy? Because I don't think anybody is completely sure that it's the people we see, the president, for example. I think the president is a figurehead, personally.
Yeah, I agree with that, and I also believe that our government, unfortunately, does not act in our best interest. And we can, you've talked about Syria tonight, not with me, but to the listeners, and I think most people in the United States would agree that attacking another country as part of the war on terror, which originated with 9/11, is not in the best interest of the United States when we are $17 trillion in debt. We are morally bankrupt in many of the things our government is doing. So my point is that it appears that our president and some folks like Tenet and Free might be working for others. If they're not working in our best interest. I talk about something that was proposed by an author by the name of Peter Dale Scott, and he's a well-known historian, and he talks about the overworld, which is, and I know it sounds a little crazy, but the overworld in his term is a transnational group of people who are what he calls the politically minded rich. So I don't go into a great deal of that in this book, but you can see behind the scenes that these people seem to be operating under the directions of a higher authority and not the citizens of the United States.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, we want to keep our focus narrowed to the point that we're dealing with your book, which is an extraordinarily rich book of over 400 pages. If it's all about the money, a while ago I floated the idea that when everybody was saying the only reason that we went over there is for the oil, well, we didn't get the oil deals. Russia and China got the oil deals. You know, Iran's the head of the snake. Well, Iran doesn't really have a history of the last war they were involved in was with Iraq. Now we're thinking that Iran would like to annex Iraq. So just as a thinking man here, not necessarily taking directly from your work, another 19. What do you think the end game is here? Why? It's like, let's go to Syria just for a second. Has it occurred to anybody that if it gets too stupid over there, the Russians are already there, and they have a lot of experience in dealing with the Chechens, for example, and all the various stans down there to the south of Russia. That they would chill it out themselves if it became too stupid. Do they think they would just abandon their navy base and leave?
Well, my impression is that the governments like the United States and Russia who are intervening and fighting proxy wars in places like Syria are doing so partly in opposition and partly in conjunction with each other, because the fact is that they do cross lines in terms of corporations. The corporations in the United States are partly owned by the Saudi Arabian government, partly owned by other government, other nationals like the Russians and the British. And so it's the corporations that really have the power. The politicians ultimately work for them in many ways. But if there's a book, when we talk about Eurasia, that area of the world, which is very resource-rich, not only with oil and gas, but other minerals and precious metals and so forth, there was a book in 1997 by a man named Zbigniew Brzezinski, who once was the Secretary of State under Carter, and he wrote The Grand Chessboard. And his conclusion, which has been followed and agreed upon internationally in many ways, is that the people who control Eurasia control the world. So, you know, Syria is one of seven countries that that were said by General Wesley Clark to have been part of a plan going back to the late 90s to invade, you know, Iraq, Iran, Syria, Lebanon. And if invade or control these countries, then you will control Eurasia. And I believe that that's part of what we're seeing with the war on terror overall.
I'm just wondering to what end.
Well, power. Power.
Is that it?
Uncontrolled power, yes. I think that, you know, the people that ultimately lead corporations and therefore the government are highly evolved power beings. They are beings that pursue power and pursue wealth, but wealth mainly, again, for power, it appears. And so, you know, to be able to control the resources of the Middle East and Eurasia is enough, I think, to lead people like that to really do things that otherwise they might have seen, or we would certainly see, as distasteful.
I'm sort of getting the idea that you reached a point that you just said, you know, this may be a little risky to go into this, but I'm going to go ahead and go into it, because if I don't go into it, who's going to go into it? Am I close here? Because it seems like writing a book like this is enough to put a man on the clothesline.
I suppose. On the other hand, the people that seem to get the clothesline are folks who are reporting on more current events. When it becomes history, it seems to be a little more tolerated. So I have been, as I said, as we talked about on many media programs, and I've been speaking out for many years, and there's no clothesline visible to me, although it's possible. But there was a man named Michael Hastings. He was a journalist in California. He died in a suspicious car wreck.
Mm-hmm. I spoke with him on the air here.
Did you really?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Philip Marshall, too.
Yeah.
Philip Marshall wrote this book, The Big Bamboozle, that he was a United pilot, and he's not with us anymore either under questionable circumstances. When the official police report was released, never saw such a comprehensive dossier on everything. They had everything in there except the flavor of toothpaste that he used, and never saw anything like it. And it just looked like just a wee bit too much detail for it to be as stated.
Yeah.
You know, this, so it worries me a little bit. And
well, you know, I think you led off the show stating that, you know, we can stand by and play our Xboxes, in so many words, you know, and forget about things, or, you know, continue with mass consumption, or we can decide that as citizens we need to take responsibility for what's happening in our world. And that's what we're trying to do here. That's what I'm trying to do with this book. And if whatever it leads to, I welcome the opportunity to have lived meaningfully, and I think others agree with that sort of approach.
I think more and more all the time, as people like you come forward and contribute to an ever-enlarging pool of truth, I wonder what will happen when we reach that point that we actually have the culprits and it's undeniable, or if there will be some sort of a tribunal held, and then the results of that tribunal sealed for 50 years until we've departed the planet. We shall see. And we'll carry on with Kevin Ryan, his book, Another 19, Investigating Legitimate 9/11 Suspects. Got a lot more for you here on the Saturday night edition of Cavani. I got a got another email from Alan. He wants to know what radical group I work for. Well, the answer to that one is Coast to Coast AM. We're pretty radical. I'm talking about flying saucers and 9/11 conspiracies and everything under the sun that might be real that's being shielded from the public eye. That's pretty radical. And am I trying to overthrow the government? Well, if I could figure out who really is the government, I might think about it. But right now, I'm not really sure who the government is. So anyway, our buddy Alan, tell us about Richard Clark and Cog and the UAE. That's chapter 6 in your excellent book, Another 19.
Well, John, that was an excellent segue, actually, because if people have, if they remember 20 years ago, Bill Moyers, who's a famous journalist, was reporting on something he called the shadow government. And what he was referring to was a program called Continuity of Government, or COG. And this actually was promoted and funded through the Reagan administration, but the intent of the COG program was to find private citizens and potentially government representatives to form a replacement government in time of crisis. So the crisis for many years was a potential attack by the Soviet Union. And in 1998, that was transformed into the crisis of a major terrorist threat on a terrorist attack on U.S. soil. And the reason I mention it is that Richard Clark, who was the counterterrorism czar from 1992 to 2001, he was among this select group, very small group of people who were going to be this replacement government. And they practiced over 20 years to essentially eliminate the Constitution and take over the United States. And so Richard Clark was joined by Dick Cheney and by Donald Rumsfeld, by George H.W. Bush, the first Bush, James Woolsey, a former CIA director. These men practiced to take over the United States government.
Practiced.
They practiced until 9/11. On 9/11 was the first and only time that COG was implemented. And so Richard Clark actually implemented the continuity of government plan on 9/11 that morning. It persisted. It has persisted over years. And one problem with it is that even U.S. congressmen have not been allowed to see those plans and what they actually mean. Certain congressmen have asked for access and been denied access through that government law. So, in any case, you know, Richard Clark is a very suspicious character. The 9 years that he was counterterrorism czar, he appeared to be working alongside people who largely are suspect in the 9/11 crimes, and that includes the royal family of the United Arab Emirates. In this book, I talk about Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates and Kuwait, which are these oil-rich royal families that govern in monarchy form over their people. They were also very close to certain people in the United States, the Bush, George H.W. Bush group, and they, in the United Arab Emirates, owned what was called the Bank of Credit Commerce International. Again, 20 years ago, if people remember 20 years ago, many times if people just remembered their history that far back, we wouldn't have as many problems as we do. But the BCCI, or Bank of Credit Commerce International, was known to be a terrorist financing network. And the United Arab Emirates owned that. And Richard Clark was basically a representative of that country through his time as counterterrorism czar. Well, another thing that's important there is that even the 9/11 Commission says that the funding for the alleged hijackers came through the United Arab Emirates, that all of the alleged hijackers traveled to the United States through the United Arab Emirates. And so the problem is that that wasn't followed up in terms of that government's possible involvement in the crimes. Take into account BCCI, the terrorist financing network owned by that country, and that Richard Clark, the counterterrorism czar, was basically representing the UAE in many ways. And he was not only representing them in business ways or in policy ways, but there were two distinct occasions in which Richard Clark personally prevented the capture or killing of Osama bin Laden in the few years before 9/11. And this is pretty well documented, even in the official investigations. A congressman asked Richard Clark very pointedly about why he tipped off the United Arab Emirates when they were hunting. They were regularly meeting with Osama bin Laden, these friends of Richard Clark, the man who was supposed to be protecting us from 9/11. He tipped off his friends in the United Arab Emirates about these plans of the CIA, and they were therefore foiled. We could have captured bin Laden many times, and even the 9/11 Commission comes out and says if it wasn't for our protection of the United Arab Emirates, 9/11 would never have happened. So, yeah, the issues with regard to Richard Clark and the other two we mentioned, Louis Free and George Tenet, appear to be these folks were coordinating or allowing these alleged terrorists to live in the United States, to work and openly use their own names in the United States. Two of them lived with an FBI informant, and all along, Richard Clark, Louis Free, and George Tenet are just letting this go.
They lived with FBI informants.
Absolutely. Al-Madar,
this is a matter of record. This is true. This is not speculation. This is true.
It is absolutely true. It is actually recorded in the official investigations. Not only that, but the CIA and the FBI it would not allow that informant to be interviewed by the 9/11 Commission or the Joint Inquiry. Now, this is... I know it sounds unbelievable, but it's true. This man, Abu Sadr Sheikh was his name, basically was a Saudi agent, and he was also an FBI informant. He was the landlord and the housemate of two of the alleged 9/11 hijackers in the year before 9/11. And they were not allowed. The FBI, the Joint Inquiry and the 9/11 Commission, requested to interview, obviously, this man who lived with two of them must have known a great deal about Al-Qaeda, and they were refused. Not only that, but his lawyer basically said that he's not going to testify, and they didn't. The reason this doesn't make any sense to me, John, is that there are other people who were captured and tortured just horrendously, but yet this man was just allowed to not only get off the hook, but a couple of years later he was given $100,000 and his case was closed.
I'll tell you, Here's the thing. This is what sends my mind spiraling upward into the nebula. What you're saying tonight makes such a completely perfect case for no term limits for people in Congress. The same crews over and over again. A real good question about now would be, you know, didn't the Somalis have Bin Laden and Clinton let him go? I think so. And it just seems to be these guys like Clark are just doing, as Eddie Temple said in Layer Cake, practicing the art of good business, just being really good middlemen. But the question is, this is what it could easily induce some despondency, and that is, these people don't care what we know. I think it's that somebody said they don't really care what you know until they find out how much you care about what you know. And I just, this apparatus seems to be so big, so well controlled, and they just look at the camera and go, we didn't know anything. And then you have somebody like this, this little gal who's a former CNN reporter, Amber Lyon, saying, oh no, we actually got paid not to run certain stories, and paid to run certain stories in furtherance of what we'll have to call a political agenda. My question at this point to you is sort of an unpleasant one, I'm afraid, but what can possibly be done about this when you continue to shine light on this, and when what happened becomes more and more obvious and still nothing happens? What do you do? Pray for divine intervention? I think it's coming down to that, because these guys aren't going anywhere.
Right. And, well, I think there are two objectives that supersede that. And one of them is that, you know, the revealing of this kind of history, the hidden history of 9/11, that's the title of one book that I contributed to. The revealing of that history helps us understand what's really going on and hopefully either prevent another terrorist attack or avoid it or at least respond to it more quickly next time in sensible ways. So if, as you said, there are people who appear, they're not just long-term congressional representatives that we're talking about, but people going through what's called the revolving door in the federal government, where they take high-level positions in government, and then they go and they profit from the policies that they put in place in the private sector and big corporations, and then they go right back to the government and they do it again, and that continues in this revolving door. Well, I believe there still is a chance to recover our democracy in the United States. There's a lot of work to do. Part of it is revealing history that has been hidden or that has been obfuscated. The other part is fighting for certain objectives. Like, for example, I believe one of our biggest challenges are the risks with electronic voting machines. And I believe that's another subject that can help us. We learn about it and we demand in our own communities that these things are controlled in ways where they can't be backdoor accessed or, because you look at the 2000 and the 2004 elections and other elections and you wonder, you know, how the results could totally contradict the exit polls, for example. So those are the things that I think about, that this kind of activity that we're doing today will help us in terms of leading towards changes that'll turn this thing around.
Yeah, wrongs really can't be made right. Once they're done, they're done. But so the only thing left really is future and to, as you say, prevent more of it. Well, that's you do what you can do. You do all you can do, and it's like you have your say and you're done, and you do whatever you can do, and then you've done it. At least you can check out of the planet knowing you did something besides just stand there and take it. Let's go to, if you don't mind, let's go to Caravan Sliney in the FAA. We're dealing with a lot of three-letter agencies tonight, FAA, UAE, stuff like that.
Yeah. The FAA and the other agency called NORAD, a military group, were the two groups that the 9/11 Commission ultimately determined were responsible, but not responsible. It's funny how that works. The failure of their communications, the 9/11 Commission said the failure of the communications between the FAA and NORAD is what caused the total failure of the nation's air defenses on 9/11. So if people
just
don't...
Just on that particular day, right?
Just on that day, just for 2 hours. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just between, just after 8 a.m. and just after 10 a.m. on that morning. All of the procedures that are normally followed were not followed, not only in terms of the NORAD, the military response, but in terms of communications between the FAA and NORAD. And so I began talking about this with two guys from the FAA, Benedict Sliney, who was the National Operations Manager, and Michael Canavan, who was the FAA's hijack coordinator. The two things that jump right out to you with these two guys is they had both just started their jobs. In fact, Sliney was in his first day on the job as National Operations Manager at the FAA. Now, this is surprising, given that he was the lead for the FAA in responding to the hijackings. And although there were other people at the FAA who were present, who had seniority over him, all of the testimony that's come out of the 9/11 Commission points to Sliney as being the guy they all deferred to in his first day on the job. Things about Sliney that also jumped out to me was that he had spent the 15 years before that as basically a lawyer for Wall Street, a lawyer for financiers. Now, he had had air traffic control experience before that, but he had spent the 80s and the 90s basically as a lawyer, a high-priced Wall Street lawyer, and for some reason decided to go back to the FAA just before 9/11, and for some reason was just given the position of National Operations Manager. And so that jumped out to me. I talk about that in the book a little bit, but the things that happened on 9/11 that Sliney contributed to had to do with the FAA requesting military assistance for the hijacked planes, and Sliney did not do that. Despite knowing about the first hijacking at 8:15 in the morning, for 2 hours he did not request military assistance. So, you know, he gave some very poor excuses about he was not aware that he was supposed to request or not aware to approve a request to make a request to have military assistance. He didn't even know, apparently, what the military was going to do if they were asked for assistance. All of this contradicts the basic procedures between the FAA and NORAD.
And is it your understanding that Mike sent an email in saying, no, it's incompetence is what caused this because there was no training protocol that would involve responding to an attack within the country? Is that straight or is that not straight?
Not from what I've learned. The things that prevented the interception had to do with the lack of communications from the FAA and a number of things going on in the military, including highly coincidental military exercises that were mimicking the attacks that day and that were injecting false radar data on the screens of the responders.
Oh, good grief. Have you noticed that just every time a catastrophe happens, there was some sort of a drill or an exercise that preceded it? We still have an hour to go with our first-time guest tonight. Take you to put this together. This looks like it's got to be a couple of 3 years.
Yeah, 4 years, actually, John. And I began looking at the people who had access to the World Trade Center in early 2009, so it took me 4 years to accumulate the information, the research, and the last year and a half, I really focused on putting it together in a book.
Let's segue just for a moment over to the Pentagon, but just between ourselves, and I've asked this question to John Lear. I ask it to Philip Marshall. Now, I can't explain this, but John Lear said, you know John Lear, he's flown, I don't know, 100-something different types of aircraft. His dad, you know, invented all kinds of stuff, and, you know, he's a hell of an aviator, and he said, totally impossible to get that aircraft at that speed and for it to hit that building at that, right at that spot, at almost ground level at the Pentagon. Philip Marshall, on the other hand, said, I said, Philip, the hole in the wall is smaller than the diameter of the fuselage, and where is the indestructible landing gear? Where are the near-indestructible engines? Where are the marks on the building? What do you make of that strike there? And then let's talk about Frank Probst.
Yeah. The Pentagon is a topic of lively discussion amongst those of us who were interested in 9/11 truth, that's for certain. You know, the exact story of what happened is still, I'd say, out of reach, but there's a lot to explain. As you said, this is a Boeing 757, and it engaged in what everyone who has seen the data has agreed was a miraculous dive, corkscrew dive, over a period of thousands, over a distance of thousands of feet, and came out of that corkscrew dive going, according to the official account, 500 miles per hour, and hitting the first floor of the Pentagon, you know, just at top speed.
I thought it was 500 knots, but it might be miles per hour. In any case, it was quite fast. And what a shot, right there, almost at ground level.
Yeah, the thing that drew me to this most strongly was that the plane hit a very small section of the building that had been the focus of a renovation plan. And I go into that in the book, basically asking the question, was this renovation project part of this attack? And I learned that the company that was hired to complete the renovation was called AMEC, A-M-E-C, was led by a man who is a close business partner of Donald Rumsfeld. His name was Peter Jansen. And not only were they hired for this $258 million renovation project in the exact small area where the plane hit, which had just been completed right before the attack, they were hired in a no-bid contract to clean up the mess, and then they were hired as the lead contractor to clean up the World Trade Center site as well. So they were in control of the evidence at the World Trade Center. They were the ones who constructed this impact zone. And I believe what happened, and I think a lot of people agree with me, is that there were explosives in the building. And I believe the explosives would explain to some extent what evidence you've mentioned, the size of the holes. It's not just the size of the holes and their ability to match up to the carbon-nosed Boeing jet, but the
perfectly round.
The question of how this jet could have punched through three rings of the Pentagon, and whether it was going 500 miles per hour or not, and you know, the question is how that carbon-nosed aircraft, aluminum fuselage aircraft, could have punched through. Now, people may say, well, maybe it was one of the engines, but then again, you've got a mismatch again, I think. But I talk about Frank Probst, as you said, because he was the main witness to this plane, close-up to this plane impacting the building. And interesting coincidences with him is he just happened to be checking the area where the plane hit in the few minutes before the attack. It turns out this guy was a lieutenant colonel, retired from the Defense Communications Agency, and now that's the agency that's in control of the satellites in the American airspace. Now he's checking something right there at the point of impact. He goes off to a construction trailer, and they talk about apparently. They talk about these attacks occurring. And then he leaves the construction trailer, and the plane allegedly flies right over his head. And it couldn't be just a matter of feet, because the plane hit just 6 feet above the ground.
Yeah.
Now, one question with that is the wake, the turbulence that a Boeing 757 generates 6 feet away from the plane is known to be dramatic.
Pretty rough, yeah, especially if it's doing 500 miles an hour.
Yeah, so how this man lived to tell a story is one question. But then he told the story, and he talked about how he was just happened to be there, and he just happened to be talking about the attacks in the construction zone. But the plane hit that very construction entrance where they were working on it, and I go into a hypothesis. I make it clear that it's a hypothesis, attempting to explain more of the unanswered questions, because we have not been successful in either fully explaining or agreeing upon what exactly happened at the Pentagon. But I talk about remote control and the technology available to control these aircraft, which was very well established on 9/11. In fact, exercises were being conducted in the months before 9/11 to utilize these technologies for guidance of a large airliner. They were very precise in their ability to control the aircraft, to bring it in the aircraft into a certain area. In fact, experts said that that planes could have been flown directly into the Oval Office back then if it was necessary. So I talk about this remote control technology and how the equipment for it, even going to the exact equipment that would be needed, how it would appear that it would have fit very well in these construction trailers, which were just outside the impact zone of the building, which is just where the plane hit. So I talk about that, and Frank Probst, as he said, and I go into a colleague of Probst, fellow West Point graduate Paul Mikar, who was hired to do the investigation of the building afterward, and how he had been accused years later of obstructing the Hurricane Katrina investigation, and how he was connected through family, through marriage, to a man who worked with Alan Dulles, the famous CIA director, and just, you know, the issues about him having conducted experiments on explosions at the Pentagon in the years before 9/11. And so all I try to do is explain more of the unanswered questions. You know, why did the plane hit that impact zone? How could it have possibly been flown, regardless of what kind of plane it was? I mean, it might have been a large plane of another type, but most of the witnesses do talk about a large aircraft hitting the building, and it did appear to be flown like a guided missile. So those are some of the things that I go into.
Well, you know, and what happens the moment that somebody is out there fooling around in their little Cessna and they start going into restricted airspace? I'll tell you what happens. A jet shows up right next to you going, you better wiggle your wings and let us know that you're going to do exactly what we tell you. And you couldn't fly into restricted airspace. I mean, around the Pentagon and the Capitol and so forth. Couldn't get anywhere near that place without having a jet on you. Before 9/11, they'd send something up there real quick. They got nothing to do all day except sit on the tarmac and wait to be scrambled. They lived for that.
Absolutely. That area that you're mentioning over Washington, D.C. is the most highly secure airspace in the country. It's got a special code, P-56 is the area. And I talk about in an earlier chapter on NORAD, the failure of the planes to intercept, the interceptor jets to intercept the hijacked aircraft. But they did this routinely every year, 129 year times in the year before, and yet they couldn't catch up to any of the four hijacked airliners on 9/11, none of which squawked the hijack code. That means put in their transponder that they were being hijacked. None of them did that. almost as if they were using technology that day that was available and was patented just after 9/11 to take control of a hijacked aircraft and shut down its communications and just do whatever it is that the remote pilot might want to do with the plane.
That sounds a lot more plausible than some guys getting some simulator training and then being able to place those aircraft right where they...
Well, that's all we have time for today, but one of the main reason I'm replaying this and reminding people that your government is run by organized crime, psychopaths, and criminals. It has been going on for a long time, and it's going to keep going on unless the people rise up. There's an uprising. Now, you know as well as I do, it's not very likely for that to happen anytime soon. But instead of worrying about voting machines and worrying about the 9/11 as far as a hobby, it's all that is to show you that your government is not a government. It is a crime syndicate of the most powerful type. And if you are tempted to look at it any other way and think you can find any other solution than changing it physically, then you're wasting your time and you're not listening to what I have to say. 14:05, I'll be back with you tomorrow, which is what? Wotan's Day. That's right, Wotan's Day.